Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle. I am your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I am joined, as always, by my guest host, the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, and the very normal Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you tonight?
What I really want to know is, how are all of our friends out in the audience?
Woo! Woo!
I'm great. Being here is with you guys for this movie is about as good as it gets for me personally.
Yeah, as always, it is great to be talking about movies with friends, especially here at a movie that is at a theater that is not just my home theater, but in many ways is almost like my home. I live not very far from here, and so there are times when I feel like I am here more often than I am at my own actual house. The good news is my wife never worries about where I am. The bad news is she always knows, Peter, why are you at the movie theater again? It's because I love the Alamo, and I specifically love this theater.
Yeah, it's funny. We were talking before the show. This is actually the third time in the last 36 hours I've been here to watch a movie. All right.
Sonny doesn't even live in Washington, D.C.
I've been to this Alamo more than the one that's 5 minutes from my house now this month.
Well, you have to catch up.
Got a problem. There are a lot of different ways to think about this movie. We could talk about the intellectual sci-fi or the social drama angle of it, the social commentary. We could talk about it as a filmmaking challenge, as an adaptation challenge. We could talk about sound design.
And we probably will, because
film editing. We're certainly going to talk about that. Don't get him started on sound design. But the thing I want to start with is just the pure gut punch emotion of this movie. Because I remember I wrote a piece for Alyssa at the Washington Post eight years ago, whenever this movie first came out, back in 2016. Because this came out, just personal info, just blurted it all out there. So this movie came out, my daughter was about a year old. I only had the one at the time. I have another one now. And watching the way this film unspooled the first time it's almost unfair to parents, and certainly parents of young children, and the way it is set up to kind of play with your expectations of how filmmaking work, right? So that whole first sequence is like Up, right? Who's seen Up? Everyone, we've all seen Up, right? With the great sequence about living your life, and you have this long life with the person, and they go away, and you have to figure out how to go on without them. And the whole movie, the first time you watch it, is kind of structured that way, as the child lives and dies, and we see her memories, what we think are her memories of the child, and learning lessons from that. And then when you find out that the child has not even been born yet, and she is going to have to make the choice to have the child and live with all of that, I think I may have literally said out loud no in the movie theater when I realized it was happening, just because it's almost unfair to the audience, and it kind of wrecked me. And I had never reacted like that to a movie before, ever, never in my life. And it just realized, much like this film is about how we could discuss the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis if we want, but much like this film is about the idea that language changes how you see the world, this film was a very key moment for me in thinking about how my own personal life experiences changed how I viewed not only this film, but all films. It sent me down a whole weird path of Rotten Tomatoes should have a parents filter, not just, I want to know who has kids when they're talking about movies. We can talk about that too. But it really did change things. Alyssa, were you able to make it through the movie this time without sobbing in your chair?
I did not sob in my chair. Okay. It's possible that I've been desensitized to Arrival, not fully, because it's impossible to be fully desensitized to this movie. But when I first saw this movie in 2016, my husband and I were starting to think about having kids. So we didn't have kids yet. And I do think that this is a movie that, beyond, the glory and the grandeur of it, is about the fact that having a child is sort of fundamentally a gamble. Right. And this is something that comes up again in Denis Villeneuve's Dune movies. Although it's interesting, and we can talk about this later, the way that the second film, in particular, sort of takes away the plot about Paul Atreides becoming a father and presumably sort of delays that until the third movie. But Arrival is fascinating in part because even though it is very modern science fiction, it is also about a very old concept, which is how would you live your life if you knew you had a fate, right? It's not that, you know, Zeus has come down from on high and is decreeing what's going to happen to Louise, but there is an extent to which her choice is not about what's going to happen, but about sort of how she is going to approach it. And in particular, it is about the decision to become a parent and to gamble that the pain that she knows she is going to experience will be made worth it or made bearable by all of the other little accumulating moments that we see scattered throughout the movie. And, you know, I've probably watched Arrival 20 times since it's come out. There was a bizarre period when I would just, it would be the movie that I kind of threw on while I was working or in the background. Come on, that's not the weirdest.
It's comfort not, food there.
It is not the weirdest movie that any one of the three of us puts on under those circumstances.
Some people watch Arrival, other people watch Godzilla versus Kong.
I mean, at least I have taste.
Who are you people? Who are you?
To be clear, I've also watched Arrival many, many times.
And, you know, I think as a parent now, I was so moved by Arrival the first time I saw it. And I understand Louise so much better now as a parent, right? I mean, I have that wall of art, you know, in my home office. I have those, you know, incredible weird stories about prescient questions that kids ask, uncomfortable questions kids ask. And I think I understand now the extent to which parenting life is made up of those tiny moments, those rocks that Hannah is collecting in the stream. And to me, the greatness of this movie is that you can watch it sort of at any life stage and be really profoundly moved by it. But also you can watch it 20 times and be really deeply moved at each step of the way.
Well, it has that circular quality in its narrative, in the way that it draws you into a story that feels like all of it is, in fact, happening at the same time. And one of the great things about rewatching this movie is that you can kind of experience it in that heptapod-esque way where you know what's going to happen and yet you've still been drawn into it and you're just sort of feeling all of the bits all at once. But this is also something, this sort of take on parenting is also something that is deeply embedded in so many of Denis Villeneuve's films, not just Dune, but if you go back to one of his French language films, one of his breakout movie, the movie Incendies, which is a war film from a few years before this came out, and it is this very dark, very difficult, but kind of profound drama about twins who lose their mother, and the mother leaves them dying instructions to find their brother and their father. And I don't want to spoil it for you, but it gets quite dark and it gets quite difficult, but it is ultimately a movie about parenting and about the value of life and about the value of those relationships, even in some cases when they are tragic or worse. And this movie is probably Arrival is not quite as dark in its outlook as Incendies is, but it still carries some of that sort of that sense of tragedies are part of life, and that is something that you have to sort of accept and deal with. And in some ways, it's not just that you have to accept and deal with them, it is also that tragedies make life worth living anyway, especially when there are children involved.
I want to talk about the adaptation of this movie because the three of us have read the short story on which it's based, and it's very good, but it's also pretty narrowly focused on this idea of if you knew that you were going to have a child, that child would die. Would you still do it? And it, you know, gets into the questions of fate and all that. And also, I mean, it deals with some of the alien stuff. But this movie is I think broader and bigger than that. I mean, I think it introduces all of the kind of, you know, international relations, tensions and all that.
All the conflict with China is new to the movie. It wasn't in the
right.
short story.
But on top of that, my real point here is that the short story is very straightforward with the setup. It's the mother is talking about the child dying, and I think it's a rock climbing accident in the
yeah, and it happens a little later in the child's life when she's in her 20s.
Yeah, but in that it is very different from the film, which is constructed, I think, very cleverly to, again, create that presumption in the audience that they are seeing a flashback, that they are seeing something that has happened and kind of pulls the rug out from under them later. And I think that's a thing that you, I guess you could do it in a book. You could do it in a novel, in a short story. The author, Ted Chiang, doesn't, but they do here. In the adaptation, Peter, what was the process like there for the screenwriter? You said he had went through dozens of drafts.
He went through many, many, many drafts. Although, you know, part of what's interesting is this started as a spec script before the screenwriter had any big breakout hits. And he what he wanted to do was draw attention to the fact that Ted Chiang is such an incredibly good science fiction short story writer. And this is a guy who doesn't, I believe he has never written a novel. He has written two books of short stories, and he is one of the masters of the craft. And in the short story, so much of the time bending is done through language. And there's a little bit of the kind of Dr. Manhattan on Mars effect, where he's using language like, or in Chiang's using language in the short story where you're the main character, the scientist, is saying things like, "I remember the time you will." Which is a construction that doesn't make sense, except in the world of heptapod language, where time doesn't have any meaning anymore, where you start in one place and end in another place, but all of those places are the same time, it of course makes an awful lot of sense. And so he brings you into that idea as a short story writer, not so much with a big twist that comes at the end of the second act where you finally get it, but instead, he just sort of slowly immerses you in the language of it. And there's a little bit of that in this movie as well, where you realize that it has slowly immersed you in the language through cinema. And this is something that cinema does extremely well, is it bends time and sort of helps you think in a way that is nonlinear. It's just almost dreamlike effect of good cinematic editing. But what this movie does is it takes that slow immersion in specific language and it translates it into a fairly straightforward three-act screenplay structure. And there's a very rigorous kind of 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 30 minutes. This is basically four 30-minute sections, right? And there's a big turn around the first 30 minutes when we first go into the ship. There is a mid-act break about an hour through where we start to realize, oh, this is how things work. There's that montage where Jeremy Renner's character is explaining, this is what we've learned, this is what we haven't. And then things take a turn for the worse in the second half of the movie as we start to realize that there's some international conflict. And we get, okay, then there's the real low point where the soldiers try to bomb the alien ship, right? And that's when things are as bad as they're going to get. And then what are you going to do from there? And the third act sort of takes off, right? And so it's this really masterful exercise in taking a kind of vague and fuzzy short story that uses language so well, but in a way that just doesn't quite perfectly translate to film, and shoving it into that three-act structure without feeling like it is just being shoved into a paint-by-numbers structure.
But can I put it a different way, Peter? Because I will confess to not loving the story of your life, that Ted Chiang short story from which Arrival is adapted.
Wow, controversy. I know we're not doing that segment, but
I think comparing the two of them is an interesting exercise in how different kinds of artistic language work, right? Because in addition to being sort of closely focused on Dr. Brooks' child, the story of your life is very tightly focused on language. And I think Chiang studied linguistics for, you know, an incredibly long amount of time to be able to write this short story. But, you know, the visual...
It's even more of an exercise in just sort of extrapolating the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. Although, unlike the movie, it never uses the term Sapir-Whorf. It just sort of expects you to kind of get it through the language that he is using.
Absolutely. And I find the writing in the story of your life a little bit dry. And again, controversy, sorry. Peter's just going to look at me like this for the rest of the podcast, and I'm going to say,
I think you feel about that story the way Sonny feels about past lives. You know, it's pretty good, but like, there's no emotions there, which is just wrong.
To be fair, that's how we all look at each other all the time.
Yes.
On the show.
But, you know, it is very interesting to think about written language and visual and cinematic language here, right? Because, you know, what does it mean to tell this story with the different music that occurs in the different segments of the movie, right? The, you know, the sort of classical Max Richter stuff that, you know, bookends the film and that sort of emphasizes the high points in Louise and Ian's sort of human life and in Louise's life with Hannah, with the, you know, very, very different music that bookends the big moments with the aliens and kind of emphasizes their grandeur. And there's no, you know, there's no linguistic equivalent of that in prose in quite the same way. You can describe a sound, but you can't pair that sound and image in the same way. It's quite as effective.
Yeah, in the story, there's an awful lot of talk about spectrographs and like how you're going to use the audio recordings of the aliens and how you're going to analyze them. There's also just a lot more scientific description in the short story, some of which is actually very interesting, but it's quite expository. So you learn how light beams always travel the fastest distance from point A to point B, and then there's like graphs and stuff. And like if you stopped this movie, like to have, you know, a whole sequence where somebody's like, let me explain how light travels to you.
No,
like, it just wouldn't.
Absolutely not.
It wouldn't work nearly as well. And part of the genius of this movie is that it manages to convey a lot of the same ideas without having to stop and explain. This is the concept. This is the metaphor. This is the science we're drawing from. It just sort of pulls you in and delivers it to you through the language of movies, through editing and image and sound.
And I do think it's possible to conjure up that feeling of strangeness in prose. Has anyone here other than me and Peter read Ray Naylor's The Mountain and the Sea?
If you haven't, it's fantastic short novel that you can read in an evening.
Yes, and it is a novel, interestingly enough, about scientists who are trying to communicate with an octopus that has developed language. And so you have some...
Maybe. Well, we find out that it has, but they're not sure about it.
Sorry, spoiler alert. Apologies. But it's got that same sense of sort of grandeur and strangeness. The language is much less stark and sort of plain than in The Story of Your Life. And so it's a novel that I've been thinking about a lot in the context of this short story in this movie, just because, again, you know, you can... As we learn from The Humans in Arrival, you know, you can speak in words with your mouth and have written language and do entirely different work with language. And at the same time, you can do entirely different work across artistic forms.
Alyssa, do you want to talk about Arrival and its place in the, in, you know, kind of smart sci-fi canon, not Star Wars, or, you know, Star Wars is smart, I guess. Everyone likes Star Wars.
This isn't the Death Race 2000 remake.
It's not sci fantasy, right? It's science fiction. And within the context, again, of the cinematic canon here, of movies like Contact.
Sure.
Or others.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we've been talking about on the podcast on and off, because it's very interesting to me the extent to which this sort of kind of explanatory, smart, relatively hard sci-fi is also often presented as family stories, right? And family stories in a way that are very gendered. You have the sort of sad dad in space genre, you know, Matthew McConaughey goes to space to deal with his feelings, Brad Pitt goes to space to deal with his feelings.
Happens to everybody.
And... yet the stories that involve women, Gravity, Contact, you know, Arrival, it's much less sort of getting in touch with your feelings and it's more sort of reconciling with a specific person, right? I mean, Amy Adams learns to talk to aliens and decides she wants to have a baby. Jodie Foster talks to aliens and feels a sense of rapport with her dead dad and maybe also is going to date cute pastor Matthew McConaughey once she gets back to Earth. You know, Sandra Bullock goes to space and deals with loss. And it's, you know, it's interesting because telling someone, you know, you're going to go to the movies and learn about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is not going to be very attractive.
They didn't put that on the movie poster?
They did not. It was not in the trailers either. I mean, it's, you know, it's a secret Sapir-Whorf hypothesis movie. But family is sort of the last universal story, not in the sense that everyone is having families and kids. In fact, that is in some ways a minority experience in America today. But it is still the idea that travels, you know, sort of across generationally, across gender lines, across borders as well. And so it makes a lot of sense that you have these movies that are really deeply emotionally attuned, but also manage to convey these complicated concepts, in part because if you're learning about the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis to learn about love, that is a much easier sell to people than you're learning about the Sapir Whorf hypothesis to get your PhD.
Well, I mean, to mass audiences.
Yeah. So there's some people out there who I'm sure that's why they want to learn about the Sapir Whorf hypothesis.
This movie is a real Trojan horse for a bunch of things. I mean, I remember watching the ads and thinking like, oh, okay, this looks like smart sci-fi. I like Denis Villeneuve. I like Amy Adams. I like, you know, I like Contact. And then I show up and it's just like, oh, here's 5 minutes of the saddest thing you could see. It's like, oh, this is not what I was expecting. And then it gets, you know, a little intellectual again. And then, oh yeah, by the way, no, we're going to go back to the gut punch. Also, speaking of cheat codes, Max Richter's On the Nature of Daylight, that's like the ultimate cheat code. That is like, you like push the cry button.
Yeah, if any of you have ever done Peloton meditations, they use Max Richter stuff all of the time, in part because I think it is kind of a cheat code to like get you into that open emotional space.
I just cried because it was so beautiful. And I'm kind of not kidding. I mean, this is a really amazing looking movie, and that's one of the things that makes it so rewatchable is just the power of the images. And so, you know, another director who I think Denis Villeneuve sort of resembles in a bunch of ways is Christopher Nolan, and he talks about the power of the single image in cinema, and this is something that a lot of directors have lost. And I think one of the reasons that you see Denis Villeneuve sort of making such an impact is that he really cares about those single images. And this is a movie that you can watch, and a year later, even if you haven't seen it, you can play back some of these images in your head. You know, the shape of the ship as this giant silhouette set against those mountains, that initial flyby where the camera just sort of curls around the base and the ship, and it's just
mist
sort of slowly
just pouring over the mountains.
Right, and then all these set shots at the end where the ship is just slowly shifting in its position, or the ships, I should say. And Villeneuve cares about that as a, this is like a, he has like an ideological bent towards like things should, that can be conveyed in one image should be, right? We don't need 10 different cuts. We don't need a bunch of coverage and a bunch of movement, just sort of, you know, shaky cam around this. What we're going to show you is the thing and the one way that this thing looks. There's just something really powerful about it, especially on a big screen.
Well, and even though Villeneuve has this reputation as a monumentalist, right? I mean, the ships in Arrival look kind of like Richard Serra sculptures. But in Arrival, he's also very interested in sort of the one image that is childlike or mundane, right? I mean, the movie returns over and over again to the drawing that Hannah makes of her imaginary, you know, mommy and daddy talk to animals show. It returns a couple of times to her Play-Doh recreation of the early conversations with the heptapods. And, you know, he is interested in the huge spectacle of the ship dissolving into mist, or Louise looking up at the surviving heptapod and seeing that she's been seeing only part of the scale of its body. But he is also very interested in the sort of intimate domestic detail as well.
Yeah. And he shoots all of these grand images in a very naturalistic low light that makes it feel like it's real in some sense. It's not exactly the way your eyes see things, and yet he has captured these images in a way that feels a little like how your eyes see things. And so this is something he's talked about, is that when he was working with his cinematographer, even after the movie had been shot, on the color timing, is just to let it be dark. Let the light be low, even if that makes the skin tones look a little bit wrong, a little bit pasty. We're just going to let these images be dark, and at times he moves almost into black and white, which you saw if you've seen Dune 2. You see that whole sequence on Getty Prime is actually shot in black and, or effectively shot in black and white, a kind of right in infrared, right, because of their black sun. And he has said, well, I invented that for the movie, it's not in the book, just because I love black and white. But you can see in this movie, which is not a black and white movie, you can see his love for black and white, because there are so many beautiful silhouettes in this movie, even sometimes where you have faces and where you would typically, a cinematographer would want to light the faces so that you could see the performances and what the actors are doing. Villeneuve is often just like, no, we are going to show these people in silhouettes, because what the silhouette does is it doesn't draw your eye to what's going on in someone's face. It draws your eye to in some sense, the power dynamic between the characters on screen, right? If you just see them in silhouette, you see the space they take up, and you see their the physical relationship to each other, and that's all you see. And so that allows you to see what is going on between those two figures on screen, turns those people into monuments in a way that just makes it thrilling to watch, because you're not just watching for the normal human stuff. You're watching for the ways that the people become, in some sense, those their own version of those ships.
Speaking of not watching for normal human reasons, Peter, you will notice all the speakers.
Yeah, they're great.
Here. So this is a Dolby Atmos setup here. What do you make of the sound? So again, this is the first time I've seen it since theaters. You know, in theaters since it came out, you know, 8 years ago. What do you make of the sound design of this film? I know that's
a... It's a great technical showcase, and it is a great technical showcase because it immerses you in an alien world, not just visually, but aurally. It takes you there. You can close your eyes, and you can hear the alienness of this world. And if you think about the way that big movie monsters have been portrayed for the last, I don't know, 30-something years, the defining sound is actually the Tyrannosaurus from Jurassic Park, from the original Jurassic Park. And like that movie came out in 93, right? In 1993. And for like 20 years afterwards, every single monster was basically that, some version of that sound, which if I recall was like they combined a lion and a tiger and it was like mostly an elephant, but then also a little bit of whale. And it's just like everything sounded like the Tyrannosaurus for a long time. And Denis Villeneuve here is moving into a totally different direction with the sound. What he has done with the sound is he has made it a sort of a sub-bass sound rather than this sort of arch, bird-like, elephantine roar.
It's more like whales.
It's a lot more like real. I mean, that's right. And you get this sort of the thump against your body, right? This movie uses subwoofers really, really well because it's not just about sort of giving you like, oh, here's the explosive whump. It's about demonstrating the scale and the weirdness of these creatures, because their voices, the sounds that they make they're more right. Like that than like language.
Well, there's this one moment in the movie where Amy Adams starts talking. She says, and then the aliens reply, and their first reply, it's you can even see it on the meter. It like comes, and then it hits you right in the chest with the however many bass speakers they've got.
But it's interesting in part because the combination of sort of a whale sound and bird fluttering is inherently illogical, right? I mean, it's not it's not a lion and a tiger, two animals that are related. It's two things that are in some ways, you know, diametrically opposed to each other in scale, in habitat, and that dissonance creates the strangeness.
Yeah, I just like listening to this movie. Almost independent of like thinking about what the story is. And this is, again, just a way that it immerses you in this outside of time, nonlinear narrative, right? In its alien way of thinking. But it brings me back, to tell a personal story to when I was a kid. I played the tuba in band because I was a weirdo. And in band, what you would have to do a lot of the time was not play the music on the pages in front of you. You'd start the day by playing not even scales, but just a single note. And everybody in the band would just have to play a single note together. And you have to hold that note. And then the band director would tell you, that sounds terrible. And you'd be like, what? Why does that? We're just playing one note. No, the note is not pleasing. And he would talk you through, make this note more pleasing, make the sound more pleasing. And this is something that I care a lot about, is that sounds should be pleasing. And they should have a kind of a textural quality to them that fills you up and that like gives you joy. And this movie has an awful lot of that. And in a theater like this, you get to hear that really well.
All right. Do we want to do questions and comments? Mm-hmm. Okay. Questions, comments, throw your hands in the air.
You can ask us about Dune 2 or tubas or speakers. Just get Peter's, you know.
Don't ask about speakers. Yeah. Do them a favor.
Not a question about speakers, but thanks so much for this conversation. So fun. I'm curious what you think about... I love this movie, like you guys. Part of, I guess, an issue that I've had in previous viewings, less so in this one, is seeing how the personal story and the international relations stories fit together. It seems that there might be more ambiguity and complexity with this idea like you were talking about, of what do you do if you know that something terrible is going to happen? How does that change your actions versus what might feel like a more simplistic, you know, sort of a, the military figures being like, you know, it's a dog eat dog world and you need to act versus kind of Louise's more, you know, we all just got to cooperate and that'll make things better. Like, do you see that? Or where's the complexity in the IR story?
Well, it was really interesting because I was, you know, like I said, I've seen this movie probably 20 times and it didn't occur to me until this viewing that unless you speak Mandarin, which I don't, you don't know what General Shang's, you know, final conversation
so
with his wife consists of. I'm sure you can find out.
I can spoil it for you.
I don't want you to spoil it for me. Stop.
It's on Wikipedia.
Why are you like this?
You can look it up for yourself.
Not helping. But, you know, this is a movie about having incomplete information and about the fact that, you know, history is made collectively, you know, there are certainly limits to the great man theory of history. But, you know, what you see over and over again in this movie, not in the personal story, is how much personal biases and perceptions and, you know, chance encounters and personal experiences and even sources of information, you know, have an impact on that overall arching story, right? So I think that this is a movie about people doing what they think is the best they can with the information that they have. And so even, you know, the movie doesn't particularly, for example, do a lot to tell us about the soldiers who set off the bomb inside the shell. But it does give you enough to see, you know, this is where they're getting their information, their news information. You know, you hear in that call between the soldier and his wife where he's getting sort of his emotional information and his valence. And, you know, part of what is sort of powerful about, you know, the title of Louise's book is The Universal Language, right? But the movie is very much about the fact that we don't have that in international relations or in our intimate experiences, right? Her relationship with Ian breaks down because she has access to knowledge that he doesn't have and makes a decision based on that that he can't possibly understand. And sometimes we manage to overcome that and it potentially ushers in a new era of scientific cooperation. And sometimes we don't overcome that and we make really tragic mistakes or make the best decision we can that isn't the right decision for someone else.
I think the IR stuff is the weakest element of the movie in the sense that it is very broadly sketched out and kind of working in tropes like the, you know, the crazed military guys or the, you know, international relations. No, but we can't all get along until you figure. But the other thing that has come up in my head this week, rewatching it again a couple of times in preparation for this and again right now, is so this is the first time I've watched the movie since Dune and Dune 2 and the first time since I read the books. Or at least the first couple. I've only read two. I don't like the Dune books, but I'm pushing through them on general principle. But those movies and books have this really interesting idea of prescience and like what it would mean to be able to kind of see the future or see possible futures, and you know what Paul Modiba Atreides has to do to kind of make it work or not work or usher in galactic jihad or whatever. But this movie totally sidesteps the most interesting question about the heptapod language, which is that if you were given a tool that allowed everyone to see the future, I feel like there'd be pretty strong controls on who got to learn to do that and how it was used. I feel like just throwing this open to the world of bad actors is not something that everyone would just be like, yeah, no, this is good. This is, everyone can see the future now. This is good. We should roll with this.
Yeah, the Heptapod Language Regulatory Authority would be well-staffed
the underground of teaching people Heptapod language. You
so
know.
In the story, it's quite explicit that that the Amy Adams character declines to explain any of this to anyone else. And she keeps this for herself. And she actually even talks about how there's a way in which in the story, that character argues that even if people knew, it wouldn't change anything, because a big part of the end of that story is about how it's not even so much that you are seeing the future, It's that there is no distinction between past, present, and future, and that to speak, to have a conversation, to do anything in a linear manner is merely to enact what was already going to happen. Now, this is a hard concept to wrap your head around. If you've ever been involved in any or read debates about free will and predestination, like you'll have some idea here. But the story does a pretty good job of making the case that in some sense, you do know the future, but in another sense, you don't know the future so much as you simply know all the things that are going to happen, that already have happened, that are happening, and that those are all the same thing, and you can't make a distinction, or at the very least, the heptapods don't, and in their language, there is no distinction, and that's how she learns to think, is not as a past, present, and future, but as a all the time, all things all the time.
The other thing is, I do think this movie does a better job of that than the Dune movies, but that's, maybe we can...
The visions in the Dune movies maybe leave a little bit to be desired. I think the thing that you were getting at, and I'll be quick here, is that there's a little bit of friction between the intimate personal stuff and the big global scale stuff. And part of the reason for that is just that the big global stakes stuff isn't in the story. It was added on. And so inherently, it's going to feel a little bit different.
We have a question up in the back.
Hey, I think earlier you talked about... She could see in the future. She knew her daughter was going to pass away, and then there was the gamble of like, do I do it anyway, kind of thing. But can you talk a little bit about the, I don't know, your ideas of the tension between, you have moments, right? Like you have memories, and memories last forever, right? It's not like time doesn't stop just because someone passes. It doesn't end, right? So these are like there is a tension of like, she is going to have this finite lifespan, but then you also have moments that you get that moment lasts forever. It seems like a far easier decision and less of a gamble, if that makes sense.
So I think there are a couple of ways to think about that. This is sort of a personal aside. I was very, very close to my uncle who died before my son was born. And after he died, I was looking back at pictures of him with my daughter. And one of the things that's really fascinating about the iPhone sort of live photo feature is that it captures sort of motion and sound. And so I have all these snippets of my uncle's voice, of him sort of talking to my daughter, to me, to my dad, that I didn't know that I had. And in a way, having those is a lot like living in the moments that Amy Adams has in this film. It is a ghostly thing to be able to raise your dead. And, you know, I did not cry during the screening of Arrival. I will try not to cry during this live show. But yeah, I mean, look, now that I have met my children, the thought of them dying is the worst possible thing I can imagine. But my son woke up the other day and declared to me that he was super whale and he was going to put his body in the ocean so he could help the fishes. And I think that would probably sustain me forever. I think that it is challenging to talk about what it is like to be a parent, you know, without sounding like a crazy person in some ways, because it is so transcendent. And I think this movie is powerful in part because it captures something that is very, very hard to put in plain language, to put in words, to state in a conversation, that commingling of total joy and utter terror and peace with that tension. I don't know if that makes sense. And
well, I mean, this is the central question of the movie and of the short story,
and
right?
And also possibly of life.
And of life, which is that an ultimate tragedy or heartbreak worth it, you know, despite getting the 10 or 13 or 20 years of joy. And I think, I mean, look, the answer in the story and the movie, I think in the movie more is yes. I think in the story, it's just, as you say, Peter, like, this is going to happen regardless. If she makes a much clearer affirmative choice, I think, in the film than in the short story. And the answer in the movie is yes, it is worth it, even if it is.
In some sense, that question echoes the central question of another movie, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is not as overtly tragic, but has a similar ethos.
One more?
Is the movie better today if Denis has the Dune money and the Dune cast?
I think this movie looks great and sounds great and is, I mean, incredibly acted. Amy Adams is a number one actress on my draft board, at least in this period of Hollywood history. Forrest Whitaker is amazing. I don't think Forrest Whitaker gets nearly enough credit in general, but particularly in this movie. Jeremy Renner.
Well, and the sort of generosity of Jeremy Renner's acting. I mean, there's nothing I look at in this movie and think, like, this looks cheap. This doesn't look good enough. I love Rebecca Ferguson, but I wouldn't trade her for Amy Adams in this movie. Amy Adams has an actorly openness, and Ferguson is adept at playing more guarded in a way that I think would not have been served as well in this movie. And I know people want Timmy Chalamet to be in everything, but... You know, I just don't see him in this particular spaceship.
He'd be good as the psychopathic soldier.
This movie was made. Yeah.
I will say a gender flipped version of this, starring Oscar Isaac as the main character, would also probably completely destroy me.
This movie was made for $50 million, which is not a small amount of money, but is not a very large amount of money compared to most big science fiction blockbusters. And I love how good it looks for that amount of money. I think often being forced to work on something more like a budget pushes filmmakers to figure out how to do things better because they don't have unlimited options. You see that here, again, going back to that idea of all of these single shots rather than, you know, just sort of so much coverage of things, we get one big picture, the right image, rather than, well, we'll try a whole bunch of different things. I do think that if you look at this movie and then you look at Dune and you look at the trajectory there over the course of the budgets, you want to see Denis Villeneuve do more movies like this, do the kinds of things that only he is doing in Hollywood right now. There have been some reports and rumors that he is circling Arthur C. Clarke's Rendezvous with Rama, which is another great science fiction novel about an encounter with a truly mysterious alien unknown presence that is gigantic, and you don't know what it is. And I just want to see him. That's what I want to see him do with the Dune money, with You Can Do Anything Now. I want to see some studio give him unlimited money to go make Rendezvous with Rama.
But also, you could make Rendezvous with Rama with a lot of practical sets and sort of judicious use of special effects to help convey enormity. And, you know, knowing where you need a bunch of CGI and where you actually don't is, you know, these days, one of the better parts of taste and discretion.
Did we have one more question in the back?
I'm wondering what you think are the most compelling aspects of the movie. Like, it's a process movie. It has a compelling question about life. Like, is there any one ingredient that you think carries the viewer through in such a compelling way?
Honestly, that's not how I think about movies. So it's hard for me to say.
I don't think there's one element that carries the viewer through in a single way. But for me, it actually is the sound. And I know that's maybe a weird way to, like, a weird response, but the sound in this movie, like I said, it's so immersive, and it just details the world for you. You don't need to know what's going on. You can just sort of, it's like going underwater, right? Like, and you can just sort of, like, sit in that. And the sound in this movie just sort of does it for me.
I mean, for me, it has always been the emotionality of it. I did not rewatch this movie for many years after. I don't know how these guys watched it 20 times. Crazy. But I literally was so affected by it after the first viewing. You know, usually when I'm putting together a top 10 list at the end of the year, I'll rewatch the things that I'm considering to put on it just to make sure. And that was one that I was just like, no, I'm good. That's definitely on there. We're going to move on to the whatever's next on the list. Because I guess that's a weird thing to say, that, like, that's what draws me to the movie. It's also kind of what repels me from it a little bit, is opening myself up that way.
I went to see this at a press screening in 2016 when it came out, and then went back and watched it again 5 days later, just, like, immediately bought it as soon as I could get it on Blu-ray, and have seen it many times since. It's 2016. I'm watching Arrival with Alyssa Rosenberg. It's 2024. I'm watching Arrival with Alyssa Rosenberg.
All right. We'll stick around for a little bit if people want to come up and talk to us. But I think we should probably. It's 10. It's Peter keeps looking at his watch.
It's a little after 10.
Thank you all so much for being here. There is just nothing better than being here with all of you.
Okay, bye.
Thank you all.